today on Against the Grain. If 31 U.S. states still have the death penalty, does that mean it's working, that it's doing what its supporters want? Or is the system broken, maybe even beyond repair, making the abolition of capital punishment ever more urgent? I'm CS. I'll speak with Matt Cherry, Executive Director of Death Penalty Focus, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The U.S. Constitution bans, quote, cruel and unusual punishments, but a majority of states in this nation retain the death penalty. Does that mean capital punishment isn't cruel? And what about claims that the death penalty is administered arbitrarily, that it deters people from committing homicide, that capital defendants don't get adequate legal representation, that it costs more to put people behind bars for life, that racial bias pervades the process by which death sentences are imposed, that the risk that innocent people will be executed means the death penalty must go? I recently sat down in studio to talk about all this and more with Matt Cherry, Executive Director of Death Penalty Focus, a national nonprofit organization based in San Francisco. I began by asking Matt Cherry how long the death penalty has been in existence in the U.S.
The death penalty has been in the U.S. since the founding of the United States, and we find that the death penalty has been a common punishment around the world throughout history, and it's really only in the last few decades that the world, and increasingly the United States, has moved against the death penalty.
So tell me about that. What's the trend in terms of states and of nations moving away from the death penalty in recent years?
Well, internationally, we have seen a massive movement from where the large majority of the world states had the death penalty as recently as 40, 50 years ago, that now two-thirds of the world's nations have abandoned the death penalty either in law or in practice. And increasingly, it's a very small minority of nations that actually use the death penalty. In fact, the United States is one of the top five execution nations in the world, along with China, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Pakistan. So that is the company we keep when we execute. And within the U.S., we've also seen a strong trend against the death penalty. In the last decade, eight states have abolished the death penalty, and another four states have imposed moratoriums on the death penalty.
And I was reading these states include New Jersey, New Mexico, Illinois, Delaware. I guess this was via legislation, but then you were saying also there are states that have abandoned it, not via legislation, but via moratoria-like actions.
Yes, there's been moratoriums from governors. There have been states that have abolished it by legislation. There have been states that have abolished it by a court decision.
How many other nations around the world currently have the death penalty, use the death penalty?
Well, there's about 38 nations that still have the death penalty on the books and may use it. But in terms of nations that actually execute people, there are only 9 or 10 countries that regularly execute more than 10 people a year. So I already mentioned 5 of those countries. The other countries that regularly execute more than 10 people a year include Sudan, Yemen, North Korea, and Iraq. So when you look at the states that actually execute more than a handful of people, other than the U.S., it tends to be very dictatorial, tyrannical regimes that still use this practice. And every other country in the Western world has abandoned the death penalty. Every single country in North America, Central America, South America has stopped using the death penalty. Every single country in Europe, in Western and Eastern Europe, has formally abolished the death penalty. They've all left it behind.
And why is the international context when it comes to the death penalty, why is that so important in your eyes?
Well, I used to work at the United Nations, and I saw the death penalty used by many regimes as a way of enforcing their worst policies and they use the existence of the death penalty in the U.S. as a justification for some of their worst actions. And whenever we will criticize some of their human rights abuses, for example, countries that would execute people for crimes like blasphemy, they would turn back and say, well, look at the United States. They execute far more people than we do. And I know from my experience at the UN that if the U.S. was to abolish a death penalty, we would very quickly see that the United Nations would outlaw the death penalty. Already, the UN, every 2 years, has a vote at the General Assembly calling for a global moratorium. And the vast majority of UN members vote for that end to the death penalty. But the U.S. lines up with another 35 or 40 countries who are the worst regimes in the world. They line up with Saudi Arabia and North Korea and those other countries and vote to keep the death penalty. And I think if the U.S. was to switch sides, we would very quickly see that the UN would outlaw the death penalty. And that wouldn't mean that, you know, North Korea or Saudi Arabia would immediately get rid of the death penalty. The UN doesn't have that kind of power. But it does mean that those countries would be classified as outlaw regimes because they deliberately kill their own citizens when they do not need to. And that is the definition of the death penalty. It's a deliberate killing of prisoners who no longer pose a threat to the public, where there are other methods of keeping the public safe, and yet the country chooses to kill those people.
Why hasn't the U.S. moved away from the death penalty, given the trends you've been talking about, given the company it keeps, the other nations that still apply and use the death penalty?
Well, the U.S. is moving against the death penalty, and we see a very strong generational shift here. So people under the age of 40 are largely against the death penalty. People under the age of 30 are overwhelmingly against the death penalty. But there is a legacy of very strong support for the death penalty in the U.S. If we go back to the 70s and the 80s, we see the death penalty used as a political tool, as a sort of wedge issue, where people who opposed the death penalty were targeted as being soft on crime, where we saw the case of Michael Dukakis. Many people blame his loss in the presidential election on the Willie Horton adverts that introduced a racial element to the criminal justice debate. And then 4 years later, we saw Bill Clinton go out of his way to show that he was willing to execute African-American prisoners. He actually left the campaign trail to go back to Arkansas and oversee the execution of Ricky Ray Rector, who was sentenced to death but was so brain damaged that he didn't know he was going to be executed. And he had his last meal and put aside the dessert and asked if he could have it later because he didn't know what was about to happen. Mm. But Bill Clinton felt that was a good way to show that he was a new kind of Democrat, that he was a Southern governor and was tough on criminals. And I think we saw that big wave in the 80s. Public support for the death penalty was very high up in the 80s. And it's taken a long time to overcome that. But we're seeing a strong trend away. Many individual states are abolishing the death penalty, and public opinion is now strongly moving against the practice.
And how much of this has to do with pragmatic concerns, fiscal concerns, understandings of how much money it takes to present a capital case and all the appeals that are required, and then the housing of people who remain in prison for sometimes decades on death row? And how much do you think has to do with ethical and moral concerns that killing people by the state in this way, in these venues, is wrong?
Yeah, I think the emerging majority against the death penalty is made up of both those components. It's made up of people who oppose the death penalty on ethical grounds, but also people who are coming to realize that the death penalty doesn't work. They may support the death penalty in principle, but they realize it is a failure in practice. And they're surprised to learn that it costs so much more than life in prison without parole. They're surprised to learn it doesn't act as a deterrent. So when we put together those two groups, the people who object to the death penalty on moral grounds and those who object to it on practical grounds, we see a new majority emerging against the death penalty.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you in detail about these arguments about deterrence and this issue of costs. But let's just sketch out a few other basics about the death penalty specifically in the U.S. About how many people are executed in the U.S. every year?
Well, it's been going down year on year. So last year, I believe it was 49 executions, which was the lowest in modern history, going back to the 1970s. And this year, it looks like it will be significantly lower than that.
And what proportion of people sentenced to death in the U.S., so on death row, have actually been executed?
I'd have to look back at the figure for the U.S. What I can tell you is in California, more than 1,000 people have been sentenced to die, and only 13 have been executed.
And do we know how many people are currently on death row around the country?
Yeah, currently there's just under 3,000 people on death row across the U.S.
Matt Cherry joins me in studio on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. He is executive director of Death Penalty Focus. That's a San Francisco-based nonprofit organization dedicated to the abolition of capital punishment. Can people who were under 18 when they committed the offense punishable by execution, can they be sentenced to die?
Not anymore. The Supreme Court outlawed that about 10 years ago.
And what about people with intellectual disabilities? Can they be executed?
Well, the Supreme Court has been moving against that, and they have said that that should not happen, but the rules are so vague that it does still happen. So they introduced a sort of rule of thumb that anyone with an IQ below 70 should not be executed.
This was the state of Florida, I believe.
Well, this was the U.S. Supreme Court, but the states have been struggling to interpret that because that's a hard and fast rule that doesn't really fit with reality, where sometimes IQ measurements vary, where people have different kinds of disabilities. So the courts are still struggling with how to interpret this rule. And although they have said people with mental disabilities should not be executed, it still takes place and there's still a danger of that happening. And we find that a large proportion of people sentenced to die still suffer from some form of mental disability or are very close to the age of 18 so that they still have immature brains or they have other mental issues that may not show up, but were clearly a factor in the crime in the first place.
Do states, and also the federal government, because there are federal capital crimes, do they distinguish between intellectual or mental disabilities and mental illness when it comes to deciding on whether to administer the death penalty?
They try to, yes, but there are all of these issues tend to be mixed up. And there's still evolving case histories on this. And I think the Supreme Court is still struggling to find a way to make this work. And the history of the Supreme Court on this issue is that they have recognized there are problems with the application of the death penalty, and they have tried to clean those up. And again, they run into problems that it's just not that simple to come up with clear rules that will avoid those problems.
And this brings us to one of the elements of an issue generally called arbitrariness, that if the death penalty is administered or assigned in an arbitrary manner, then that's not fair. And given what's at stake, either the system needs to be fixed or we need to get rid of capital punishment. So I think here you're referring to arbitrariness by location, that states or counties may have different likelihoods in terms of how defendants are treated, how they are sentenced, whether they are given the death penalty or maybe given life in prison without parole. So how important is, let's say, the county in which the crime is committed, how important is that to the likelihood of a death sentence?
the location of a crime is incredibly important to how it is treated, how it is punished. And when we look at the arbitrary nature of the death penalty, we see that geography is incredibly important, but it interacts with the other arbitrary nature of the death penalty to do with race and economic status. So we see, for example, that 2% of all the counties in the U.S. account for 50% of the death sentences.
2% of all counties in the U.S. account for 50% of death sentences?
That is correct. And it's overwhelmingly dependent on where the murders are, which jurisdiction those murders take place in. And five of the 15 worst counties are in California. So we see that California is a huge part of the U.S. death penalty system.
Yeah, there's been talk of a new death belt in California, in Southern California. The counties, I believe, are Los Angeles, Orange County, Riverside, San Bernardino, and Kern. Are we talking then about kind of the discretion of the local prosecutor, a willingness maybe of a judge in certain jurisdictions, judges in certain jurisdictions to dole out the death penalty?
Absolutely. It's very dependent on the prosecutor and also on certain judges in those jurisdictions. And when we look at the politics and the racial makeup of those jurisdictions, we see that there is a lot of political posturing by prosecutors who are trying to get votes by proving they're tough. And we see that there's a lot of racial disparity in those counties. So some of those counties you mentioned, for example, Los Angeles, 98% of death sentences are for people of color. In Orange County, this is from a study Harvard just issued where they looked at 5 years of death sentences. In Orange County, 89% of death sentences were for people of color, and 44% of death sentences in Orange County were for African Americans, even though Orange County only has a population of 2% African American. So we see these incredible racial disparities, which are reinforced by white prosecutors, white judges, white juries. And we see this across the country. People think it's a problem in the Old South, but it's just as much a problem in California and other states that still use the death penalty.
How much does the race of a victim, let's say of a homicide, affect the likelihood of a person being given the death penalty?
It has a huge impact. We do not see many death sentences for black-on-black crime, but we see a lot of death sentences where the victim is white and the accused is black. In fact, across the modern history of the death penalty, there have been 300 African Americans sentenced to die where the victims were white, and only 30 white people sentenced to die where the victim was black.
What did the U.S. Supreme Court decide in the case of Furman v. Georgia, the decision came down in the early 1970s?
So the Furman ruling in the early 70s outlawed the death penalty as it then existed. It found that it was unconstitutional because of its arbitrary nature. So the Supreme Court then came back a few years later and tried to impose new rules for the states to follow that would make it less arbitrary. And they required, for example, separate sentencing phases of capital trials so that the death sentence was handed down in a separate trial from the verdict about guilt.
So there's like a guilt phase and a sentencing phase.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, since then, the states have been trying to find ways to apply the death penalty that are less arbitrary. And frankly, they have failed. It's still incredibly dependent on location, on race. The death penalty is mainly used against people who are poor or poorly represented or people of color. And we're seeing now that the Supreme Court itself is beginning to question whether the death penalty can ever be applied in a non-arbitrary manner. So we've seen many former Supreme Court justices, like John Paul Stevens and others, who have said it cannot be fixed. And now we're starting to see people actually on the Supreme Court, like Justice Breyer, recently issued a ruling where he said that he wanted to hear whether the death penalty could be considered a violation of the Constitution, and laid out page after page of arguments as to why the death penalty should be considered unconstitutional.
What about the racial composition of juries? Has that been linked to the likelihood that a person is executed or sentenced to die?
Yeah, there's a number of problems with jurors in death penalty cases. First of all, in order to serve on a jury in a death penalty case, the juror has to say whether they would support death penalty. So people who have a moral objection to the death penalty are immediately taken off that jury. So those are known as death-qualified juries, and there's a ton of research that shows death-qualified juries are not only more likely to support the death penalty, they're more likely to support a conviction, they're more likely to make mistakes. And one other factor in the death-qualified jury is they're more likely to be all white, because support for the death penalty is stronger amongst the white population than amongst people of color. So we already see that there's a selection taking place in that jury that makes it less fair. And then in addition, there's a long history of prosecutors getting rid of people of color from capital cases, and indeed from other cases, so they can get a jury that they think will be more favorable for a conviction that may be more biased against defendants of color.
And to continue with this issue of race, there is the case of Dwayne Buck, who was sentenced to death after his own lawyer presented expert testimony from a psychologist. What did that psychologist say?
Well, as you say, this was a psychologist called up by his defense, and he was asked by the prosecutor whether a African-American defendant would be more likely to commit a crime in future. And he said that was the case. So the so-called defense expert actually made a racist argument that was used to convict Dwayne Buck. And then when Buck appealed this blatant racism, the court said, well, you can't appeal it because it was your own side who called this expert.
That case has gone to the Supreme Court?
It's currently before the Supreme Court.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Matt Cherry joins me. He is Executive Director of Death Penalty Focus. Before joining the organization, he served three terms as president of the UN NGO Committee on Freedom of Religion or Belief, where he led hundreds of religious groups and civil society representatives in efforts to protect the basic human right to freedom of thought and conscience. He also was an international representative for the International Humanist and Ethical Union. Well, you mentioned the issue of deterrence earlier this hour, and this is a big thing, right? Because supporters, proponents of the death penalty will say, well, hey, it deters people from doing heinous things, right? If they know that they might be executed or sentenced to die because of a homicide, for example, they won't do it, or they'll think twice about doing it. So what has been found regarding whether the existence of the death penalty has a deterrence effect, whether it in fact deters people from committing, say, homicides?
I actually have some sympathy for the argument for deterrence for the death penalty, because I think it's natural to think that if someone is threatened with death, they will think twice about a crime. But the evidence shows that it doesn't have a deterrent effect. What does have a deterrent effect is the possibility of being caught. And we know that less than 50% of homicides result in a conviction. So that, you know, a lot of people committing murder aren't thinking they're going to be caught. And also the certainty that you will be punished. And we know that the threat of life without parole or other severe punishments are just as effective as the threat of capital punishment, especially since capital punishment is so rare and arbitrary and unlikely to be enforced. So the evidence has shown that there is no strong deterrent effect or any deterrent effect for capital punishment. And there have been a number of studies on this. And recently, the National Academy of Sciences reviewed all of the studies on deterrence and murder and capital punishment and found there was no evidence that capital punishment deters murder.
Yeah, and that report came out in 2012. I read somewhere that police chiefs ranked the death penalty last among effective ways to reduce violent crime. These are police chiefs.
Absolutely. And I think they know not only that the death penalty doesn't deter crime, but the death penalty takes money and resources away from programs and efforts that would actually deter and prevent crime.
What's the relationship between the fact of whether a defendant will receive the death penalty and the quality of the legal representation that he or she has been given?
Well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Supreme Court justice, said she had never seen a case come before the Supreme Court for capital punishment where the defendant had been well represented. She said, if a defendant has good counsel, is well represented, they will not receive the death penalty.
Wow. And is that assertion of hers, is that backed up by the evidence, by studies?
Absolutely. If we look at people who are on death row, overwhelmingly, they tend to be poorly represented. And we find that the counties and the states that produce most death penalties have the worst defense counsel as well.
And by worst, do you mean just in terms of competence? I mean, and all, you know, we've heard of stories about defense lawyers falling asleep at the trials of their clients who then get eventually sentenced to death. But is it just incompetence, or is there actually something relating to unethical conduct or people who are, say, suspended from their bars or disbarred?
Well, what we find is a lot of states are very reluctant to adequately fund defense attorneys. So the people who end up taking capital cases tend to be, in many cases, less competent. I mean, I have to be careful in saying this because there are so many fantastic defense attorneys, but the people who actually get convicted and sentenced to die often have very poor representation, and that is because the defense attorneys are not funded, they're not given adequate training, and they don't have a budget in many cases to adequately defend their clients. So they avoid doing research, they avoid getting independent forensic expertise because they can't pay for that.
Yeah, I want to just point out two studies that I came across in preparing for the program. An examination of 461 capital cases by the Dallas Morning News found that nearly one in four condemned inmates has been represented at trial or on appeal by court-appointed attorneys who have been disciplined for professional misconduct at some point in their careers. And in Washington State, a 2001 news report revealed that one-fifth of the 84 people who faced execution in the 20 years prior to that report were represented by lawyers who had been or were later disbarred, suspended, or arrested. Now, this is, you know, information that kind of goes to the extreme, and I hear you about lawyers who are really trying their best but who are overworked and underpaid and under-resourced. So what is the argument that the problems, for example, and let's just stick with legal representation in this case, are so big and so profound that really there is no way to administer the death penalty in a fair, equitable way?
I think that is absolutely the case in practice, because we see that the people who are the strongest supporters of the death penalty, the politicians who are the strongest proponents of the death penalty, are also those who are most reluctant to invest money in an adequate defense. So the people who want to keep the death penalty are the people who refuse to invest the money that would actually make it fair.
That's Matt Cherry, Executive Director of Death Penalty Focus, a national nonprofit group. We'll take a short break and speak more with Matt. Please stay with us. Thank you. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Matt Cherry is Executive Director of Death Penalty Focus, a San Francisco-based nonprofit organization dedicated to the abolition of capital punishment. He is former president of the United Nations NGO Committee on Freedom of Religion or Belief, and he's also served as an international representative for the International Humanist and Ethical Union. Let's talk in some depth here about money and the question of what saves more money, what saves taxpayers more money. And, you know, so a lot of people think, well, wait a second. So, okay, if someone's going through a capital case, maybe they have more appeal. So on the front end, you know, in terms of court costs and lawyer costs, that's much more than, say, somebody who's eventually sentenced to life without possibility of parole. On the other hand, you know, if they're on death row and then they get executed, well, then, you know, the state doesn't have to worry about all the costs of incarcerating this person for the rest of their life. So on balance, so if you add up everything, how does it, what saves taxpayers more money?
The death penalty is overwhelmingly more expensive than life without parole. So if you want to save the taxpayers money, replace the death penalty with life in prison. And if we look at California specifically, we see that the death penalty costs about 18 times as much as a sentence of life without parole. And since the death penalty is reintroduced in the late 1970s, California has spent more than $5 billion on a death penalty. And that's $5 billion more than it would have spent if the ultimate punishment had been life in prison.
And is this because so many people on death row just languish there? Like, essentially, they are serving out life sentences without possibility of parole?
That's part of it, yes. A California judge last year said that a sentence of death in California was in reality a sentence of life without parole with a remote possibility of execution. And so what we find is that 98% plus of people sentenced to die in California have not been executed. And out of those people who have been sentenced to die, the vast majority have not completed their appeals process. So all of this money is being spent on appeals attorneys, and the people are just sitting there serving what is, in effect, a sentence of life without parole, but with more attorneys and more privileges and more expenses than someone who is actually sentenced to life in prison.
Santa Clara University School of Law Professor Ellen Kreitzberg, I read, said that in California counties where you have a lot of death penalty cases, you've got 35% of a court's staff time spent on those cases. Is the system equipped to deal with this?
Absolutely not. The death penalty system clogs up all the other court services across California and across the country, all the way up to the Supreme Court. And we find that these cases and the appeals take time away from the court's other business. They cost a great deal of money, and they achieve absolutely nothing in terms of preventing crime or keeping the public safe.
So there are so many layers of the onion to unpeel here. Another is this issue, it's a controversy around the administration of lethal injection drugs. Tell us about that controversy over, and I think it's whether the use of these drugs constitutes cruel and unusual punishment, which is banned under the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
Right. I think it's worth taking a step back before we look at the specifics of lethal injection and look at an overarching issue here, which is that the U.S. Constitution bans cruel and unusual punishment, as you say, but the death penalty is, by its very nature, cruel and brutal. So we have this intrinsic contradiction between the ban on cruel and unusual punishment and the idea of humane homicide, which is what the death penalty is striving to be. The death penalty inevitably is going to be cruel, and the effort to make it somehow humane always runs into these problems. So we've seen a trend over the last few decades to try to sort of sanitize the death penalty, partly because they're trying to meet legal requirements to avoid cruelty, and also because there's a segment of public opinion who supports the death penalty in the abstract, but is very uncomfortable at the brutal reality of putting someone to death. So we see a lot of contradictions and problems arising out of this. And the attempt to introduce lethal injection as a method of execution makes it look more medical, more, you know, it sanitizes the method of killing, but it has created its own problems. First of all, although they try to make it look medical, medical personnel, medical organizations will have nothing to do with the deliberate killing of prisoners. So what ends up happening is that the lethal injection is administered by a prison guard. They pay, you know, $500,000 cash to a prison guard who will volunteer to take part in the execution, but they may not even know the difference between a vein and an artery. They have no training, no skill. We also see that the drug companies object to their medicines, which are designed to heal people, being used to kill people. So the drug companies have refused to sell any of these drugs to prison departments for use in executions. So we're increasingly seeing departments of corrections shopping on black markets, going elsewhere, looking for these drugs. We see them using unskilled personnel. And as a result, the executions are increasingly being botched. We're seeing many horrific cases where the execution, which is meant to be painless, is clearly very painful. The prisoner is struggling, crying out, saying their veins are burning, and in some cases have taken 40 minutes or an hour or more for the prisoner to die.
What's happened to legal arguments that, you know, this situation is untenable from a legal standpoint?
Well, I think we're seeing those arguments occur more and more, but there's been a lot of dissembling and dishonest responses from the states. And increasingly, the states who support the use of the death penalty are just trying to hide the whole process from the public. So they're trying to make it secret where they get the drugs from, so there won't be questions about their purity or their provenance or whether they actually work. They're trying to hide the actual execution so that if the execution is botched, there won't be inquiries or bad publicity. So the response has not really been to fix the problem, but to sort of shroud it in secrecy and hope that the public doesn't get too upset.
Do you think there'll ever become a situation in which these drugs are so difficult to get, even on the black market, that states will just say, we need either another method or we just need to abandon the death penalty?
Yeah, I think we're very close to that point right now. Many states that have the death penalty on the books cannot obtain the drugs. And those few states that still have the drugs, it's unclear whether they will have a new supply when current stocks run out or expire. And I think we're very close to the point where it just may be untenable to continue executions using lethal injections.
It's remarkable that we've gone this far without talking about innocence. And I mean, that's come up in the context of racial prejudice and certain other biases that may mean certain people get the death penalty. But maybe the clearest way into the issue of innocence is exoneration. So how many people on death row have been exonerated and released because of evidence indicating their innocence?
Since the 1970s, we have seen 156 people who were sentenced to die be exonerated because they did not commit the crime.
What does that say to you?
That says to me that the death penalty is inevitably error-prone and that we cannot afford to have an irreversible punishment that has such a high error rate. I actually don't think we can afford to have an irreversible punishment that has any error rate. So even one innocent person is too many. But to see 156 people definitively exonerated from death row shows that the system does not work.
And of course, there may be many other people on death row who are innocent and who just haven't had their evidence gone through in that kind of manner.
Absolutely. We also know of people on death row who died on death row before they can complete their appeals, even though they had very strong claims of innocence. And the standards for appeals is very high. It's much harder to demonstrate your innocence once you've already been convicted than it is to avoid conviction in the first place. So we're looking at very high standards of innocence here. But we see again and again that convictions are shoddy or flawed or biased or error-prone. And very often, the exonerations are not the result of the system working. It's because people on the outside or groups like the Innocence Project have taken up these cases, not the state itself, but outsiders have championed these cases and brought forward new evidence and proven the innocence of these people. It's not a result of the system itself actually working.
Matt Cherry is Executive Director of Death Penalty Focus. They're based in San Francisco. They are a national nonprofit that advocates for alternatives to the death penalty, for abolition of capital punishment. And among other things, he, in his life before Death Penalty Focus, served 5 years as Executive Director of the Council for Secular Humanism, and then 8 years as ED of the Institute for Humanist Studies. So Matt, earlier this hour, you mentioned your sympathy with this feeling that some people may have about deterrence and, hey, if the death penalty can deter people from committing homicide, then, you know, there's some kind of justification for having it. What about this issue of closure? You know, we hear a lot about families of victims wanting the perpetrator to be executed because it would constitute a kind of closure. Have studies been made to find out how many families actually feel closure when the death sentence is meted out?
Well, the argument that we should support the death penalty because it provides closure for victims' families is a fairly recent argument. We didn't see this back in the 80s or 90s to any great extent. So the number of studies that have been done of this are fairly limited because it's a pretty new argument. But the studies that have been done do not show there's a benefit from the death penalty for the murder victim family members. I know many murder victim family members feel that it will provide closure. I don't want to argue about individual cases because obviously people vary. But the studies that have been done show that the main thing is that there should be a conviction and a sentence that they feel is commensurate with the crime, and that there should be finality about that sentence. And what happens with a death penalty is it actually doesn't provide closure, because a death sentence is not, it's just the start of the process. Whereas if you sentence someone to life, they immediately begin serving their sentence. Justice starts immediately. You sentence someone to death, it's the beginning of decades of appeals. So the closure does not come. They have to wait for decades and hear the case brought up again and again. They may be facing the killer in court again and again. And so the closure doesn't come from the immediate execution of the sentence. And then we also find that people, when they actually come face to face in the death chamber and see the sentence carried out, it doesn't provide the satisfaction they thought it would.
What do public opinion polls nationally and or in California say about support for the death penalty or opposition to it?
Well, historically, there has been strong public support for the death penalty. And if we go back to the 1980s, the 1990s, we saw support for the death penalty up into the 80% level. But it's been dropping year after year, decade after decade, ever since then. So the most recent public opinion polls, including a Pew poll a month ago, show that support for the death penalty has now dropped below 50%. Which is the first time that's happened in 40 years or more. And we're also seeing that when people are given a choice between supporting the death penalty or supporting life without parole as the ultimate punishment, then we see a majority support life in prison. If people are asked the question in the abstract, the support still tends to be higher for the death penalty. But when they look at the reality and are given a choice, we see that support for the death penalty is falling to record lows, And nationwide, it's now below 50%. And in California, we see that when people are given a choice on the ballot, the polling shows that there is a majority who would support abolition. We certainly know that the trend is very strongly in the direction of abolition, and that every year, every election cycle, more and more people are willing to vote against the death penalty.
Florida does not have a ballot measure, but it did have a recent case, an important case, decided on October 14th by the Florida Supreme Court. This was a decision about jury recommendations for the death penalty. What did the court decide?
Well, Florida is one of a handful of states that actually allowed people to be sentenced to die even when there wasn't a unanimous jury in favor of the death penalty, which is pretty shocking when you think about the desire to have certainty and to reserve the death penalty for the worst of the worst, yet states allow death sentences to be handed down even when the jury that's heard all the evidence is divided about that. And the courts have recently ruled that that is not permissible, that if there is to be a sentence of death, it should be unanimous, and that it should be based on the jury hearing all of the evidence in the case. And that's still working its way through the court system. So one response to that has been in Delaware, where they did not require unanimous juries for the death sentence. And that was found to be unconstitutional. And the legislature in Delaware did not try to fix that. They accepted that was the end of the death penalty. There was already strong support for abolishing the death penalty there. So Delaware has joined the other 20 states that have abolished the death penalty in recent years. Florida is still working through that issue. The legislature seems to be inclined to try to fix the system, but we'll see how that goes, both with new legislation in Florida and also a series of appeals to hear the cases there.
As we begin to sum up, right, we've got 30 states in the U.S. that still allow the death penalty. We do have lower poll numbers in support of capital punishment, as you mentioned. But, you know, we still have a lot of liberal states, you know, so-called liberal states like California that actually have the death penalty, even if they're not executing many people. So what do you think? I mean, is death penalty on the way out? Is it just a matter of time? Is there still enough critical support for it among the public and lawmakers and courts that we should expect it to continue for a while? Where do you stand on that?
Well, you know, there's an old saying about bankruptcy, that it happens very slowly and then all at once. And I think we'll see something similar with the end of the death penalty. We're seeing it disappearing state by state. We're seeing even within states that have retained the death penalty, the number of sentences is declining. The number of counties and jurisdictions that issue death sentences is declining. The number of actual executions is declining. So we're seeing across the board, by every metric, there is a reduction in the death penalty. The only question is, at what point does it reach a tipping point where the courts and the public finally turn against the death penalty? And I think we're seeing signs of that already. For example, this year we saw that the DNC, for the first time, took a position of absolute opposition to the death penalty. So the Democrats have been split on this for many years, but now they took a position calling for the abolition of the death penalty in all jurisdictions. I think we will see a big tipping point when we abolish the death penalty in California, because California accounts for more than one quarter of all the people on death row in the U.S. It accounts for 30% of all new death sentences in the U.S., and it is by far the largest segment of the U.S. death penalty system. And secondly, the death penalty in California, it's one of only two states where the death penalty can only be abolished by a popular vote. Because the death penalty was brought back by a ballot initiative, it requires a ballot initiative to overturn it. So I think when we have a popular vote of the people to abolish the death penalty in the face of very strong, well-funded opposition. That will send a clear signal across the country that the death penalty belongs in the dustbin of history.
Matt Cherry, Executive Director of Death Penalty Focus and former President of the United Nations NGO Committee on Freedom of Religion or Belief. Thank you so much, Matt, for joining us.
My pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.